Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Very happy to be with you. Very, very happy to be with you. I've been away a lot in March, and this will be the most I will be away all year. So I'm glad March is coming to a conclusion. But I do want to thank Edgar and did Thomas cover for me while I was away? Thomas and Edgar both covered for me while I was away in Georgia. Just outside of Athens, Georgia, and I'm very, very happy to be back, and we've got a great show for you today. 2 hours with Jimmy Akin, and it's Ask Me Anything, and there'll probably be groovy music. So all those things recommend hanging around for a while. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, and The Drama of Salvation, and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett. How you doing?
I am doing pretty well. Thank you very much. I think we might be at the half. Are we nearing the halfway point of Lent? I feel a little better usually when the first day. Are we, Darren? Are we near the halfway point? I start feeling like, oh, I might survive this. So I'm feeling pretty good right now.
Good.
And you?
Oh, I'm doing good.
Good. And what's on Mysterious World today?
Well, this week I'm looking at a religious mystery, and it's one that is particularly a subject of discussion here in America. It's the rapture, idea that at some point in the future, but before the second coming, all true Christians are going to get caught away to be with Jesus in heaven for a period of time. And so this is a controversial idea. It only goes back about 200 years. In Christian history, and a lot of people don't realize that most Christians even today don't believe in it. But it is something that's very popularly believed here in America. There are different theories about it. There are different biblical passages used to justify the idea. And so I go through all those and sort it all out on today's episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Very good. The rapture. Check it out. You can go to mysterious.fm. Go to Jimmy's YouTube page or anywhere that you get your podcasts. It'll be there. That you can't just be in some places and be one of the most popular documentary podcasts on the internet. You got to be everywhere. So wherever you're getting your podcasts, look for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. The number 888-318-7884. There are three lines open. That is shocking to get 3 minutes into the show with Jimmy and three lines still open. So this is an opportunity for you. 888-318-7884. We're going to start out with an anonymous caller in Pennsylvania listening on the Catholic Answers app. Anonymous, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. So I'm on the board of my college's Newman Club, and the Newman Club is taking part in an upcoming Interfaith Week that the school is sponsoring. So the different religious clubs are hosting events and inviting one another to it. So we got invited to a Jewish Seder service in a few weeks, and I'm looking for specific details on what's actually permissible and what's not regarding how the club extends this invitation to the members.
Well, surely extending an invitation to your members is something that's going to be governed by club rules, and I don't know the rules of your club.
So we don't have any rules about this.
Okay. Well, you're asking
more
moral
principles. Yeah,
okay.
More a moral question.
Well, so a Seder meal, for people who may not be familiar, is essentially the modern Jewish equivalent of a Passover meal. Now, they don't sacrifice lambs these days. The Samaritans actually do. There are a few hundred Samaritans left in Israel. And every Passover, they go up on their sacred mountain, Mount Gerizim, and sacrifice Passover lambs and then have a more traditional Passover meal. But but Jews do not sacrifice Passover lambs because they no longer have their temple in Jerusalem, which is where the lambs were slaughtered. At least after a certain point in history, that's where they were slaughtered. And since they don't have the temple, they don't slaughter the lamb, but they do have a ritual meal that commemorates the Exodus event, and it contains, you know, dialogue out of the Law of Moses about here's what you're supposed to say and how is this night different from all others and why are we doing this and we were slaves in Egypt and then the Lord delivered us and so forth. And there is no barrier to Gentiles being invited to this. Back in the day, in biblical times, you had to be actually circumcised in order to eat the Passover meal, but that is not in force today. And so Jewish individuals may invite non-Jews to attend a Passover meal, and one can respond to that by accepting the invitation. There's not a barrier on the part of Christians to do that. You're not denying Christ by going and having dinner that commemorates the Exodus. And so as long as the event in question doesn't contain anything that's been added to it that would deny the Christian faith, it's permissible to attend a Passover Seder. Sometimes Christians have gone further than that and tried to construct Christian equivalents of the Passover Seder. And that is very problematic on multiple grounds. One of them is that Paul says Christ is our Passover, and so we shouldn't be recreating events that have been superseded in the Christian movement by, for example, the Mass, which is our equivalent of a Passover Seder. It's also problematic because the Passover Seder is something that's holy to Jewish people, and it's kind of bad form to horn in on someone else's religion and start co-opting and recreating, you know, versions of its sacred rituals in another religion. So I don't recommend that people hold Christian Passovers, but if you're invited to a Jewish Passover, there's no problem in going.
Anonymous? Well, all right.
Hello, thank you. May I ask a quick follow-on?
Yes, quick, mm-hmm. Please.
Okay, so then it's not bad to invite everyone because I'm a board member. As a board member, so advertising this in an official capacity is not problematic?
No, you're just letting people know we've got an invitation to go to this thing, and if you want to go to it, you can go.
Got it. Thank you very much.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Let's try to get another caller on here before we have to take a break. Our friend Luke in Seoul, South Korea, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Welcome back, Luke. I think we have a little delay today. I'm not sure. Luke, are you there with us? Oh, hang on, Luke. I know what the delay is. I pushed the wrong button. That was me, Luke. I apologize. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Luke?
Hello, Jimmy. Good morning.
Howdy.
My question is to Jimmy, why was Philomena, St. Philomena's feast day removed from the Roman calendar?
Well, I haven't researched that in particular. In fact, I don't even know that it was, but assuming that it was, I would assume it was part of the calendrical reform that occurred in the 1960s. There was a desire to clear some space on the Roman calendar because it had gotten, you know, rather a lot of saints on it. And not all of these saints had had worldwide devotion being showed to the saint. And so it was decided that they would clear some space on the Roman calendar and allow individual saints that had local devotional groups to continue to celebrate them on a local level, like in a particular diocese or in a particular monastery or in a particular nation. But unless the saint had global significance, a lot of them had their feasts removed from the universal calendar. They may still appear on the particular calendars that are used in specific locations or for specific groups, but they're no longer on the universal calendar. And if St. Philomena's feast day is no longer on the universal calendar. I would assume that's why. It was just part of the calendrical reform that occurred in the late 1960s.
Okay, Luke.
All right. Thank you, Jimmy. Yes.
And thanks for taking your Saturday morning to call us, Luke. It's always nice to hear from you.
You're welcome, sorry.
All right. Well, maybe we'll talk to you next Saturday, Luke. I got to go to the break. Thank you very much. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
You know, we talk story with each of our very unique guests for the whole hour so that you can go deep with us as you yourself pursue your own story of heroic virtue and as you pursue intimacy with God.
The Bear Wozniak Adventure, Saturday night, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. And it's, you can ask him anything because it's called Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Let's go to James in Waco, Texas, listening on 98.3 FM. James, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question. So me and my wife were talking about animals going to heaven, and we both kind of come to the conclusion we don't think so, but my wife is ex-Protestant, and she was saying that, well, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your Savior in order to go to heaven. So we were curious about, like, there was Coco the gorilla that was a sign language gorilla. If someone evangelized to that and the gorilla understood and accepted Jesus Christ, would that particular gorilla be eligible to go?
Okay, so there are a number of different issues here. Let's deal with the sign language issue first. There have been a number of attempts to teach various other primates American Sign Language or perhaps other forms of sign language, and the results have been disappointing, to say the least. They have also been overhyped. In the case of Coco the gorilla, her thief and caretaker was a woman who had, she'd originally gotten her on a loan from a zoo and then just kind of kept her. And she, you know, taught Coco or tried to teach Coco sign language and then would represent Coco as being much more fluent in sign language and then she actually was. For example, a few years ago, she released a video of Coco talking about global warming and how concerned Coco was about global warming. And when you watch the video, if you know sign language, yeah, you get the message, but it's clear the video has been staged. They cut together a bunch of things of Coco gesturing particular signs, but it's very clear that the animal has been coached. it does not really understand the concept of global warming. And she similarly made bunches of other claims about COCO that are completely implausible. And responsible anthropologists have regarded a lot of the claims about COCO as being pure fantasies of COCO's caretaker. There have been other attempts also to teach other primates sign language. For example, there was a chimpanzee known as Nim Chimpsky who was taught sign language. And it's clear when you look at documentation of things he actually signed that he didn't have a robust human sense of language. Like the longest... And this is from memory, so it's not exact. But the longest sentence that Nim Chimpsky ever produced was something he was talking about an orange, and he wanted to eat the orange. And he said something to the effect of orange, 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 Nim Chimpsky, orange, 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 me give. And, you know, it wasn't articulate. It conveyed the idea that he wanted to eat the orange, but he was not using grammar functionally, and grammar is an essential part of all human languages. And Nim Chimpsky just did not have it, and that tends to be true of a lot of the research that has been done into teaching primates language. They just are not capable of using it in a human way. I've seen this myself. I have planned for a long time to do an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on animal language where I'll cover this. And I did research for this episode. It hadn't come out yet, but I did research for it. And so I was watching videos of caretakers interacting with primates, trying to teach them language, and I saw how much resistance the primates were given to their human caretakers. They did not want to be doing this, and the human caretakers in some instances were basically forcing them to sign. And whenever you're doing something like that, that is not normal natural language usage from someone who knows a language. This is training an animal that does not want to be doing this to make gestures that it doesn't want to be doing. I have one of my cousins is actually deaf, and so is a Native American Sign Language speaker. And I asked him, could I send you some videos of people signing with primates, and could you, with a Native ASL perspective, tell me what they're saying if you were to translate it literally, and, you know, what your impression is of the animal's linguistic ability. And he said, sure. Unfortunately, he then passed away prematurely before he could do that for me. But I still plan on producing the episode at some point. Even if you evangelized a gorilla by American Sign Language, I doubt very much that the gorilla would actually understand the essence of the gospel or the message of salvation or anything like that. Having said that, that's a separate question than can animals be saved, meaning have a positive afterlife. The Catholic Church's understanding is that you don't have to have an explicit faith in Christ in order to have a positive afterlife, as long as you would be willing to accept Jesus if you knew that he was the savior of mankind and so forth. So I wouldn't consider it a barrier just because the gorilla doesn't have an explicit faith in Jesus and understand who Jesus is and what his role is in salvation history. The bigger question is going to be, do animals have afterlives? And on that, the standard opinion, the most common opinion in Christian history, has been that animals don't have afterlives. This was, for example, the opinion of St. Thomas Aquinas. But this is not actually church teaching. This is just theological opinion. And so the opinion stands or falls not based on church authority, because the church doesn't back it with its authority. It stands or falls based on the arguments that are used in its favor. And a few years ago, I looked into this and I reviewed all the arguments that St. Thomas Aquinas presented. And I conclude they didn't really work. They're not theological arguments. They're philosophical arguments, and I don't think they work. Furthermore, I'm aware that there are reports of animal afterlife, including in near-death experiences, and in particular, there are reports of what are known as peak in Darien experiences involving animals. Now, that's P-E-A-K, like a mountain peak. And the reference to a peak in Darien, it comes from an old poem where you have some explorers down in Darien province, Panama, and they're climbing the mountains. And some of the explorers who were up ahead get to the peak of the mountain and can see the Pacific Ocean. But the other explorers who are behind them can't see the Pacific Ocean because they're not far enough down the trail, but they can see the experiences of the people who are up at the peak. And this phrase was lent to a phenomenon where people are having either a deathbed vision or a near-death experience. And so the people who are having the deathbed vision or who are having the near-death experience are like those who are up at the top of the peak of the mountain, and they can see what's in the next life. They can see what's on the other side, whereas we can't see that, but we can, especially in the case of a deathbed vision, see what they're experiencing, or we can see them reacting to the sight of the next world. Well, one of the things that happens in peak in Darien experiences is people will see departed relatives coming to welcome them into the afterlife. And sometimes they see people that they did not know were dead. Like there's a famous example from a little more than 100 years ago of a woman, a British woman who was dying. She had a bunch of brothers and sisters. Many of them were around her, but some of her brothers and sisters had died. And as she's on her deathbed, she's seeing a vision of her departed brothers and sisters. And so she's like, oh, here's this sibling, and here's this sibling, and here's this sibling, and they're welcoming me into the afterlife. And here's my other brother who's alive and well in India. What's he doing in the afterlife? And this was so alarming that one of her sisters who was there ran out of the room. Well, it then turned out they get a letter a few weeks later saying, we regret to inform you that your brother who is living here in India has in fact passed on. So she saw him in the afterlife, even not knowing that he had died. And this was then verified. So that's what a peak in Darien experience is. And it turns out that there are peak in Darien experiences involving animals, where people will either have a deathbed vision or a near-death experience, and they'll see, oh, here's my grandmother, and she's holding my cat Fluffy, who should be at home and is alive. But no, Fluffy's in the afterlife. And then it turns out Fluffy had also died. So I actually did a search of a major online data bank of near-death experiences, or repository of near-death experiences, and animals are mentioned in like a quarter of them, or up to a quarter of them. And so I actually think we have empirical evidence from deathbed visions and near-death experiences that animals, at least some animals, are in the afterlife and have a positive experience of it from what we can tell. So I would say that the gorilla might be, I don't think the gorilla would likely understand the gospel if you preached to it in sign language, even if it knew sign language. But I think that it is possible for animals to have positive afterlives, at least based on the evidence we have at hand.
And James, thank you very much for the question. I hope it was helpful to you. I'm going to move on now to Eileen in Michigan. Eileen, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah. Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si. Hope you guys are good.
Very good. Thank you.
Good. So my husband and I have been reading the My Daily Bread devotional during our Lent. Mm-hmm. And we've just kind of been a little, I don't want to say confused or off put, but some of it, you know, is as if God is talking to us. And it talks a lot about, you know, sin and hell and a lot of things. And we just don't know if, you know, it's, I guess, okay for us to be reading in terms of, like, the church's stance. We haven't seen anything negative about it when we've researched it, but I just kind of wanted your insight on that.
So is the source of concern the fact that the devotional at times appears to put words in God's mouth?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And but you haven't seen it attributed anything to God that's false?
No, not necessarily, but I guess, like, there's even, like, times where, I don't want to say it refers to, like, visions, but, I mean, just things that I feel like aren't necessarily, you know, a fact or true, or, mm-hmm. you know, true, but it's not,
okay.
there's false things, no.
Okay, and does this devotional have an imprimatur?
A what? I'm sorry?
An imprimatur. It's an official permission to publish granted by a bishop, typically.
I'm not sure. I know, I think it was okay. a priest that wrote it, but I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, that's not necessary. That's not the same thing. But we'll discuss it further when we come back from the break.
If you can just hang on, I'll put you back on with Jimmy when we come back. We got to take this quick break. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. One line open right now, 888-318-7884. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little groovy music for you. Eileen is on the phone from Michigan asking about devotionals that seem to put words in the mouth of God. Jimmy?
So I have two further clarifying questions. The first one is the material that's attributed to God just quotations from the Bible or paraphrases of things in the Bible, or does it go beyond that? Does it look like new material that's not derived from the Bible?
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like it's derived from the Bible. It's not okay. material that I would say is, you know, crazy out there.
Okay, and,
it definitely...
and second question, is this material claimed to have been presented through private revelation, or is it clear that this is just material that the author of the devotional has come up with?
No, it doesn't seem like it's a private revelation.
Okay. So I understand your concern about having material, you know, placed on the lips of God that does not come from the Bible and so forth. You know, that's going to be something that is a matter of individual taste. The church doesn't have a rule that this can't be done. And in fact, you know, historically, many authors have imagined what God would say to various people. And they, you know, as long as they're not claiming he literally said this so that you're, you know, expected to believe it, as long as it's just something to reflect on and think about, it's permitted to do this. It's not to everyone's taste. You know, like personally, I really don't like songs that are sung in church that are expressed from the viewpoint of God, but the congregation is singing from God's viewpoint without some framing narrative or framing device to indicate we're not God, but we're quoting God or something. But it's not forbidden. And if the devotional has an imprimatur or permission to publish, which is typically printed up at the front of the document, like on the copyright page or near the copyright page, then that means it's been reviewed by church authorities and found to have at least some value and also found not to contradict anything in the faith. So that's a positive sign. It's not an infallible sign because, you know, bishops and their advisors can make mistakes. But the mere fact that it contains material that's presented as if God is speaking it is not an automatic reason to reject it. It may not be to your taste, in which case you don't want to read it, but that's up to you.
Okay, Aileen?
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. Ethan's in Washington, D.C., watching on Catholic.com, our website. Ethan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thanks for having me. So I was recently given a book by a friend that is a pro-same-sex relationship Christian book called Scripture, Ethics, and the Possibility of Same-Sex Relationships. And there's two arguments in here that I'm not quite sure how to respond to. And so I was curious if I could get your initial thoughts on it and kind of ideas on how you might respond to these arguments. The first one is that the traditional Catholic or Christian view of the Bible fails to take into consideration the need of believers or people with same-sex attractions, which causes more harm than good, and that Scripture can be interpreted and a way to accommodate for this need. And some of the examples that were given were David and his companions fleeing from Saul, eating the bread of the temple, which was unlawful for them to do, but given their need, was permissible. And another was Jesus and his 12 disciples eating the grain and picking the grain on the Sabbath. Even though it was unlawful for them to do, it was permitted in these instances. And that the same sort of approach can be taken with people with same-sex attraction.
Let's do that one.
Okay. So I would find that implausible. What Jesus is doing in passages that are connected with the Sabbath, and those are two of them, is correcting a misapplication of the law as it was popularly understood in his day. And he makes the point that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And consequently, if a human need contravenes the Sabbath, you can go ahead and fulfill the human need. So he points this out on one occasion by saying, which one of you, if his son fell in a pit on the Sabbath, would not immediately pull him out? And the answer is nobody. Nobody would not pull their son out on the Sabbath if he fell into a pit, because the son has a human need, and that obviously takes priority over the ritual requirement of rest on the Sabbath. He also says that, and this is also from the pluck and grain passage, he says, therefore, since the Sabbath is made for man and not man for the Sabbath, the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. So he has the authority to rule on whether or not things like his disciples eating grain on the Sabbath or, you know, plucking grain on the Sabbath in order to fulfill their human need of hunger, it genuinely contravenes the Sabbath or not. And he says, no, it doesn't. So we know Jesus's attitude is that human needs supersede the ritual applications of the Sabbath that were being exercised in his own day. But that doesn't mean that you can just abrogate any law on account of a perceived human need. For example, Jesus makes it really clear that if you are genuinely married to someone and then you divorce that person and you marry someone else, you're committing adultery against your first spouse. Well, okay, but you could say, oh, but I couldn't live with my previous spouse. Okay, fair enough. He didn't condemn the idea that people might need to separate because they can't get along together. But then having separated, that doesn't give you the right to marry someone else or start sleeping with someone else. And you can say, oh, but since I don't have a spouse right now, I don't have any sexual outlet. I really need to be able to sleep with someone that, even though it's adulterous, I really need to be able to commit adultery. Okay, that argument doesn't work. You either need to, as St. Paul says, you either need to reconcile with your first spouse or you're going to need to live in continence. You don't get permission to sleep with someone you're not married to just because you have a perceived need for sex. And the same considerations are going to apply to individuals who have same-sex attraction. No one's denying that it can be challenging for such people to live incontinence, meaning not having sex, just like a divorced person or a widowed person may have challenges living incontinence, but that doesn't give you the ability to sleep with people you're not authorized to sleep with. So the mere argument that human needs trump certain applications of the Sabbath does not give you a license to say, well, the same thing's going to happen with sexual ethics. And so if someone perceives themselves as having a need to sleep around with people they're not authorized to sleep with, then it's okay for them to do that. So that's what I'd have to say to the first argument. What's the second, Ethan?
Great, thanks. So the second argument in the book is about, it's a concept that they said that homosexuality as we know it today is a relatively new concept, and that you have to, the argument is that you have to look at the Bible through a historical and cultural lens, and that what the Bible really is referring to are acts of domination or the act of pederasty, and that the two consenting adults, and that when it comes to the Adam and Eve story, their takeaway was that it was more so about companionship and less so about the fact that they were male and female couplings. So I was curious how you would respond to those.
Well, I would say that the modern conceptualization of homosexuality is something that has not been present throughout all of history the way it is presently articulated. But there have been homosexuals all the way down through history, and the Bible does interact with the concept, and it speaks negatively of homosexual behavior. This is something that's admitted. I was watching a video by Dan McClellan, who is a liberal Mormon scholar, who himself is very pro, what's the right way to say it? He's very, very open or even in favor of non-traditional sexual things, including homosexuality. But even he acknowledges there are passages in the New Testament and in Scripture more broadly that speak negatively of homosexual behavior. They didn't necessarily conceptualize it exactly the way we do in terms of, you know, a person who has a stable attraction of unknown origin towards members of the same sex. They didn't necessarily think in those terms. But when it comes to the behavior, even people like Dan McClellan, who are otherwise favorable to homosexuality, acknowledge that there are passages in Scripture that speak negatively of it. He just doesn't feel bound by those passages. And I have to say, I mean, this isn't the place to offer to go through all the different passages that there are, but the claim that none of them are condemnatory of same-sex sexual behavior is just false. They are not all about domination or pederasty or things like that. They do contain references to what we would consider homosexual behavior, and they reject them.
And you know what? That brings us right to the break. So if you, I hope that got to everything you wanted. I thank you for the call, Ethan. We'll take the break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Is prayer powerful? St. Alphonsus Liguori put it this way: he who prays will be saved. He who does not pray, well, you get the point. Prayer can bring us salvation. It's the means of putting us into communion with God, and God can do all things. The more our will lines up with the will of God, the more powerful our prayers, and the simpler they become ultimately: be it done to me, Lord, according to thy word. That's the prayer God will always answer.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Hey, visit shop.catholic.com this weekend, where the code MADNESS saves you 30% off prices store-wide. Don't miss out on the final 4 days of this elite deal. Want a Bible? 30% off. Want one of Jimmy Akin's books? 30% off. Want a prayer book? 30% off. Looking to pick up the newest Catholic Answers release? 30% off with promo code MADNESS all weekend long. Where? At shop.catholic.com. All right, let's go to Columbus, Ohio, where Tim is watching on our website, Catholic.com. Welcome, Tim. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Jimmy. My question to you is, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 1658, it states that we also must remember the great number of single people who are single not by their choosing, but due to life circumstances. So This is sort of like a two-part question. My first question is, if these people never end up getting married, does that mean God was calling them to celibacy their whole lives? And then my second question is, since God is all-knowing, why would he call someone to a vocation they can't fulfill?
Okay, so in regard to the second question, God is all-knowing, and he does not call people to vocations they can't fulfill. He does call people to live the Christian life in circumstances that may be difficult, but as St. Paul says in the Corinthian correspondence, God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able to bear, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape. So he does call us to face difficulties as part of the Christian life, but he does not ask the impossible. So if someone is in a state where they are unmarried or celibate, that's the same thing, then God will give them the graces needed to live that circumstance out. In terms of the first question, celibacy is not a vocation. It is an aspect that has become part of certain vocations, but there are only three vocations that the church classically recognizes. Those three vocations are the married life, which obviously doesn't involve celibacy, the ordained life, which for some ordained people, but not all, involves celibacy. And the third is the religious life, which traditionally does involve celibacy, but it's not an essential part of it. And all three of those vocations, whether to the married life, to the ordained life, or to the religious life, are stable states of life to which one must freely assent and join at a particular moment. So there's a moment where you consent to be married, and then you're married. And there's a moment where you consent to be ordained, and then you're ordained. And there's a moment where you take religious vows, and then you're under religious vows. These all have to be voluntarily chosen. For people who are single, but through not their own desire, who would prefer to be married, that's not a vocation. That's a state of potency, which can then manifest later in becoming married, for example. So God does not call people to be celibate. He also does not call people to be single. That's not a vocation. The single, you sometimes hear people say that the single life is a vocation, but that's, they're really doing that on their own to try to make single people feel better, as if they had a special calling to be single. They really don't, the way the church understands it. There are situations in which a person who is single may not be able to be married for one reason or another, but that's not a vocation. A vocation is a stable state of life that one voluntarily agrees to at a specific point in time, and through that stable state of life, one does good in the world, such as by being a pastor of souls or prayer or raising a family or things like that. But the single life itself is not a vocation. God does not call people to the single life. He may call someone who, for one reason or another, can't get married to, he in fact does call people who, for one reason or another, can't get married to live out the Christian life in that circumstance. But the vocation is to live as a Christian, not given the circumstances, not to live as a single person.
Right. I understand that, but I'm saying there's a lot of single people who want to be married who never end up getting married. So does that, they don't have this desire for celibacy. So does that mean God is calling them to marriage and they just can't fulfill it due to the fact that marriage is a free will choice between two people and it's a fallen world? Or does that mean God is calling them, like, you know what I mean? Like, I guess God is not calling them to marriage or something. I don't, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Well, God is, God doesn't, people often think in terms of having single vocations, like God is calling me to this vocation and I've got to make it happen. But really a vocation, because they're voluntary, they have to be voluntarily agreed to. It's better to think of vocations as invitations for, here's one way you could serve God and do good in the world. But the fundamental vocation that all Christians have is to live as a Christian. God does not necessarily have a vocation for every person beyond that. I mean, you could propose that he does, but that would be theological speculation. What we know he does is invite certain people to serve him in various ways through vocations. But that doesn't require that, oh, God is really calling you as a single person who would like to be married. God is calling you to marriage, and you're just not able to do it. That's one way of looking at the situation, but it's not the only way of looking at the situation.
Tim, I'm going to try to get everybody on that I can this hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Thank you, Tim. Joe is right here in San Diego with us, watching on YouTube. Hello, Joe. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
What is the threshold for the church to make a public excommunication of an individual or individuals spreading hatred either explicitly or implicitly and claiming their Catholic faith informs their hateful worldview?
Okay. First of all, Joe, kudos on the concise presentation of your question. I really appreciate that. the church only excommunicates people for a handful of offenses, and neither spread in hatred nor claiming to justify hatred by one's Catholic faith carries an excommunication. So this is just not an excommunicable offense. That's not to say that a hateful person couldn't incur excommunication, but it would need to involve something more than just spreading hatred or invoking their Catholic faith in defense of the hatred. So excommunication is not what the church would do. Instead, what the church would do is clarify, and this would typically be through a statement by the bishop, by the person's own bishop, although it could be done in other ways, is clarify that the person's message of hatred is not consistent with the Catholic faith, and that, in fact, the Catholic faith does not support their message of hatred. But it doesn't involve an excommunication. It would just involve a clarification.
Does that make sense to you? Joe?
Yes, that does make sense. To follow up, if I may, what more must they do? You mentioned they must do more. It can't only be the spreading of hatred. What more must they do to pass that threshold of excommunication?
Well, they could physically assault the Pope. They could kill unborn children. They could desecrate the Eucharist. They could violate the seal of confession. You know, those are the kind of ecclesiastical crimes that do carry an excommunication.
Okay, so, but they would have nothing to do with the spreading of hatred.
No, I could imagine, like, let's suppose someone hates unborn babies, and the hatred they're preaching is against unborn babies. You know, mankind is an evil, we're ruining the planet, there need to be fewer and fewer human beings, and so we should abort all these babies. And then they act on that, and they start aborting babies. Not just preaching aborting babies, but actually doing it. Well, in that case, they would get excommunicated for the aborted babies, not for their hatred of unborn babies, but for their execution of unborn babies.
I tell you what, I'm going to leave that there and see if we can get another caller on. But Joe, thank you very much for the call. Joshua's in Columbus, Ohio. Joshua, if you can be kind of quick, we can probably get you an answer this hour.
Hello.
Hi, Joshua. You're on the air with Jimmy.
Yes. Questions regarding the Stations of the Cross. One is, where do we get the name Veronica? And second, why do we have Jesus falling three times? It is my understanding that he only fell once in the scriptures. Thank you.
Yeah, so I guess I'll back up to where we get the Stations of the Cross. They were inspired by visits that people would make to the Holy Land during the Middle Ages, and they would get to walk the Via Dolorosa in Jerusalem, and they would see the places that these things happened to Jesus, and then they would come back home and talk to people about what they'd seen in Jerusalem. And other people are like, well, I can't go all the way to Jerusalem, but I want to participate in this in some way. And so they would set up local Stations of the Cross. So you could kind of, in your own way, do a virtual tour of the Via Dolorosa. That's the road of suffering that Jesus walked. And so the number of Stations of the Cross varied over time as different people implemented this virtual walk in different places, and it was informed by the spirituality that people had back home in Europe. And one aspect of that was, well, stuff's more dramatic if you do it in triples. You know, that's why lots of jokes have three beats. You know, there's one beat, there's a third beat, and the second beat, and then the third beat is the punchline. It makes it more dramatic. And so instead of having him fall once, you have him fall three times to emphasize just how bad the situation was. When it comes to Veronica, the name could be derived from the name Berenice, from which we get Bernice, but given the face on the cloth, it appears that it may be derived from another origin, which is Veronica, which would mean true image of Christ. And it may be connected to things like the Shroud of Turin and other reported images of Jesus's face captured on cloth.
I appreciate that you got those out quickly, Joshua. Thank you very much. I hope that that addressed what you were looking for. We have got to take a very quick break, and then we'll be right back with another hour of Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. And if you've got a question, let me tell you right now, there are two lines open. You can get on one of those lines right now, and we'll get this break over with quick and get back to answering questions. 888-318-7884. If you're on the line, just hang on the line. We're only going to be gone very briefly. Right back with more Catholic Answers Live.